Well, hello there, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. It's February 2nd, happy Groundhog Day, if you are particularly inclined to that sort of folklore belief system, however you want to call it. Personally, I think there's going to be more winter, and somebody from the West Coast who now lives on the East Coast, I'm okay with that. I'm sort of getting used to this new little snowy feeling I have inside of me, if you want to call it that. It's another feature-length conversation today. It's about an hour long. And I really enjoyed having Mark DeBonis come on the show and talk about his upcoming move to Los Angeles. He's been doing stand-up here in Toronto for the last 10 years, and like so many folks, he decided to make the journey out west. He's been going back and forth for a little while now, but he's making the move permanent. He's doing two farewell shows here in Toronto, one tomorrow, February 3rd, and then one on Monday, February the 5th. And he also has a new comedy EP out, The Man with 1,000 Words, and it's great. We talk a lot about it. You know, he's got bits about food, kung fu movies, stupid jokes, and even the alphabet. And he has a great joke that I'll let him tell you later on. But yeah, let's get to it. This is me and Mark DeBonis. Mark DeBonis, hello, welcome. How's it going today?
It's good. It's good. The weather is, keeping me alert.
So. I thought it was like, okay, where it's gonna get warm, and it got cold again. We were talking before. I'm from the West Coast, so winter's non-existent. To us, and we were sort of joking about a little bit about how the West Coast and Vancouver, in particular, has just become kind of pretentious, very, very pretentious. I mean, what do you think Vancouver has against the rest of the country?
I think it's the scenery. Like, I really do. I think it's the only way I can really describe the people there are like pretentious hippies. It makes no sense. It's like, you know, I guess they have like a lot of rain, but they don't get the snow. You know, so I don't know. There's something, maybe it is another world out there. Like, they have no care about what's happening outside of their border.
That's very true. And yet, ironically, you're packing up for a move to the West Coast, although you're going to Los Angeles. And many comedians and actors and people in this business do that.
Yeah.
Why is now the time for you to do that?
Well, there's a lot of things. I've been doing stand-up for 10 years, and I knew from an early point that I was going to go to New York, right? L.A. was never an option for me. And I started working on my green card maybe 3 years ago now, and I just got lazy with it. And then, you know, when certain people started showing that they were going to be running the country, I was like, oh, maybe I should, you know, really step up on this because – you know, even though we're Canadian, we're still considered immigrants, right? Like, it doesn't matter. So then that's when I put everything into the high speed. And I ended up driving to LA with my friend to drop his car off. And there was something about it that I liked. I think the main thing was I had no idea what to imagine Los Angeles to look like. Because I started thinking, New York, you see it in movies, TV shows, cartoons, everything. You know it's a big city. I always thought LA was kind of like Saved by the Bell college years, where, or like Baywatch, where it was like stores on the left and beaches on the right. And I thought that was all of LA and then Beverly Hills. And I'm like, I don't want any of this. I don't like this. But I'm like, well, this is just a city, you know? And it was so different that then I was like, I went back into my original thoughts, because when I first started stand-up, I didn't know what I was doing. I followed my gut. And then once I started doing things, I started following my brain. And I'm like, you know what? Let me go back to my gut. And long story short, even though I've wasted everyone's time, that's why my gut, my gut's telling me right now LA is where I got to be.
You know, it's interesting because as someone who comes from an acting background, I've had several friends, you know, either come go to LA or come here from Vancouver. And yet it's been, it's never been a city that's on the radar for me. Like, I've always been New York or the UK.
Yeah.
What do you think it is about, like, why do you think so many people, and especially so many people from Canada or small town US, choose LA and Hollywood as opposed to, you know, New York or London or Sydney or something like that?
You know, I can't say much about overseas stuff, you know, because for me, even that's very far in the back. I think the only reason why I ever wanted to go to England was because when I was a kid, I used to skateboard a lot and I loved Jeff Rowley and he was from England. And I was like, I gotta go just to skate. But I don't know, man. Like, I think New York is obviously, like, they're both cities that the media has told us are amazing. Right? And LA, everyone thinks is just such a pretentious, stuck up, you know, like plastic surgery. And there, it is that just as much as New York, just as much as Toronto, probably everywhere else. But it's like, I think what happens is people go to Los Angeles with actual big hopes and dreams. And it's a very sad place. Like, when you have that, because it's so spread out that you are going to be alone. Right? So New York is so cramped that you're always in the middle of it. And it's just, I think in the end, you got to see, like, if you're into something that is based out of Chicago, maybe that's where Chicago is. But obviously acting and writing is more in LA, but there is a lot of stand-up in New York. Like, stand-up is huge in New York. It's the beast, right? So it's very, it is very weird. And I think it's just obviously the weather also. Like, in the you know, to have that weather all the time, it doesn't hurt anybody.
You know, you mentioned that LA is a very sad town, and art in and comedy in particular is often driven by depression and by sadness. So, you know, in preparation for this, do you prepare yourself to be disappointed? Do you prepare yourself to be disappointed and then use that to maybe fuel your material, fuel your act at all?
Yes, in the sense that I was living in New York and LA already for months at a time, right? And I've learned the one thing everyone always says, I guess it's in any industry, is make sure that you're ready, right? And it's like, when it comes to stand-up, you got to look at the reality of the situation. In New York or Los Angeles, you're not going to get more than 7 minutes. And 7 minutes is probably good, right? So you talk to any comic who's been doing it for a year or two, they have 7 minutes, right? Like, they think it's probably better than it is, but they have that time. But the idea of being ready, in my opinion, is what are you doing from 9 a.m. to 7 p.m.? That's the part that's crazy. And can you not perform for weeks at a time? That's what it is. So for me, I'm mentally preparing for a lot of downtime, right? So when I first started planning on going, I lost 60 pounds, like, weight-wise, not to get into shape for movies or whatever, because I don't even really care to act. It was more to build a routine because I need to have a daily schedule when I'm down there. Because, you know, when you're in your own city, yeah, you can wake up, walk around, see some friends. But when you're in a foreign place, every minute feels like an hour and every day feels like a year. So it's a very long process. And then one of the first things I'm going to do is try and get a job. Like, I'm really looking at it as resetting my life from, like, being 18 years old again. And that's my mentality going in, where, yeah, I love doing stand-up. And, you know, obviously just as you're about to leave, all this shit starts happening, right? Like, everything starts, people, hey, you want to film this? You want to do this? You want to do that? But you got to sacrifice it and, you know, rebuild to grow stronger. And that's how I'm looking at it. It's a long-term game.
You know, Canada and Toronto has a long history of comedy. You know, yeah, we've got Kids in the Hall. We've got SCTV. Is there a certain Canadian comic identity, do you think?
I think there's one that we've been told exists but doesn't exist. There's actually, my friend was saying this yesterday, like, I never really grew up watching, like, unfortunately, a lot of that stuff. And I love Saturday Night Live, which is funny because Lorne Michaels is from Toronto. And but I did, he was telling me that this whole, A, you know, Canadians are like, hey, you know, all that stuff. That is apparently, and it might not be true, my friend might have just been saying this and I'm just going to look like an idiot here, but that was apparently all created from Bob and Doug McKenzie. And that is literally the image that we have been painted as ever since. So I think there is, pound for pound, an amazing amount of talent in Canada. It's just, we look like idiots outside of Canada because everyone just thinks that, like, it's, I know it sounds cliche or hack, but people literally think that, like, we ride moose in small town America. Like, it's, I've never even seen a moose, you know? Like, it's crazy what everyone thinks outside of Canada of Canada. But I think it is, there is something that's happening here in all fields. Like, not just comedy, music, you know, like, film. And, you know, you got Letterkenny, which is destroying it right now. I don't know if you've seen the show on Crave. Like, it's killing it, you know? So there is something, but it's a weird identity because I tell my friend that comedians in Canada, I feel like we're Shaolin monks because we're just training for nothing, you know, like, and that's just the unfortunate reality until there's a bigger industry, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you have a, you have an EP coming out, The Man of 1,000 Words.
Yeah.
Releasing, how does one go about creating and releasing a comedy album, everything sort of taped in front of a live audience, yeah. You know, the process of putting something like that together?
Well, I've actually been releasing EPs for maybe like 7 years now. And four of them, this will actually be my fourth to iTunes. Because what happened was when I started, my friends just stopped caring that I did stand-up. And I couldn't get anyone to come out that I knew to shows. So on my birthday, I would tell my friends, hey, I'm doing all my new material from the past year, and I would promote it as a party slash, you know, show. And that, mainly that was to, you know, challenge myself to write new material, you know, work on performing at my best while I'm recording, which is very hard because when you're recording anything, you forget that you're a comedian, right? Like, you forget that you can go off book and all this stuff. But it is a bit of a process because for the most part, I self-produce them. I work with Comedy Records, which is Canada's really only comedy label. But it's like, you have to have the audience mic'd, which people don't understand. You know, you need to have the stage mic mic'd. And yeah, you need to perform. Like, I like to do at least 3 shows so then I can pick and choose, like, what's going on. But I don't want to edit it too much. But on the other hand, it's like, I'm doing jokes that I know have worked before. So I'll give myself, instead of adding a laugh track, which people, I don't think people do anymore, I'll just do multiple shows. So one of the shows, like, you know, I got at least a 75% chance that the jokes are all going to work. Yeah. So it's a process.
You have one track on there called Stupid Jokes.
Yeah.
which I like. And, you know, you sort of play with this idea that, oh, to succeed today, comedians, you know, need to be edgy or, you know, need to push the envelope, break the barriers. Do you think part of that has to do with, you know, because we're living in such, you know, the world of the PC police and, you know, things that weren't offensive 10 years ago, you could be walking your dog and somebody could take offense to that. As a professional stand-up, how do you sort of navigate those waters and maybe invert that in a way?
Now, you got to understand, my act is, for the most part, 100% clean. So this is all opinion and not on my own thing. I actually think it's the exact opposite now. I think now people are going so reverse PC that you can't do anything even on stage because I don't know if you saw this whole thing about Tom Segura. He's a professional comic. He had a Netflix special and he said a word, I don't even, like, I feel weird saying it. It's a word that we all said as kids, you know, and it became socially incorrect or whatever. And then the whole joke was talking about how you can't say the word anymore. And then there became a petition on Netflix to get his special taken down. And that to me is like, that's the end. Like, I don't know what the next chapter is. It's gonna, I think we're going back to like vaudeville. We're going back to silent art because you can't say anything without, like you said, you're walking your dog, you know, and you make eye contact with the wrong person, you're in trouble. Like, it's, you can't do anything anymore.
I think Sarah Silverman said once, you know, because people like Jerry Seinfeld and Bill Maher says we don't want to play college campuses anymore because we can't. Like,
they're very, in the States, they're a lot different than Canada.
And Sarah Silverman was of the opinion, she's like, I get what you're saying, but isn't then the duty on the comedian to try and figure out a way to adapt whatever material they're doing to these younger audiences?
Yes, but you got to understand as an audience... and Sarah Silverman obviously knows this. Some people aren't listening to your set. They're listening to trigger words. So you could literally have a joke that is just killing. And if your last word is something that is a socially unacceptable word in whatever day of the week it is, you're done. Like, the whole joke is out the window. Like, all, there's no street cred anymore in your own set because people are just looking for reasons to tell everyone that they're doing something wrong, you know? And it's, and it is, you know, you do get comics out there. Like, I was actually laughing with my friend about Hannibal Buress getting arrested last month for, like, getting into a fight with a cop in Miami. And I was just joking with him about it. I'm like, finally, this is like old school celebrity getting arrested, not for someone pulling out, I don't even know if I have to swear here, but it's like, you know, someone not doing something sexual to, you know, it's like, this guy's just knocking out cops. And like, that is like just such a classic thing that's just everyone can enjoy, you know, like, but not obviously, no one wants to hit a cop, but in the sense that it's crazy, you know, like, I don't know. It's very, you gotta really walk on thin ice these days.
It's interesting you bring that up because I heard an interview with Phil Rosenthaler today, who ran Everybody Loves Raymond.
Oh, okay.
And he was saying that now one of his issues is that sitcoms have become so vulgar and overt, and part of the reason that Raymond worked was they would make a joke about the word without actually saying the word.
Like innuendo.
Exactly. Are we, and I think we can relate this to not just comedy, but larger society in that, are we losing our nuance at all, do you think?
I think, okay, so here's the thing. Are we allowed to swear?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So, like, let's say you want to do a dick joke, okay? I don't do them. It's not that I look down on them. But that's not how my brain works. Trust me, if I had 10 minutes of dick jokes, I would love to go on the road because it kills when you're out of any major city. But here's the thing. Exactly what you're saying is if you can actually, a good dick joke, a good shit joke even, is a good joke. The problem is it a good joke or is it a comic just looking for a reaction? And that's the problem. So yeah. Even with what Sarah Silverman's saying, and Everyone Loves Raymond, it's like, yeah, you can imply something, and everyone can get it without saying it, but that's an actually really good comic, right? So I think the problem is now there's so many more comedians, which means there's so much more garbage out there, which means there's also so much more good comics out there. And I just do think that it's like, yeah, a lot of people I feel are going for effect, you know, and you can really tell. And it's a lot of new comics and people don't know if someone's been doing stand-up for 1 year or 10 years, right? So it's like when you watch an open mic and there's seven guys talking about the same thing, yeah, it gets old, you know, it gets old quick. So I do think you can do a little bit of like magic, you know, sleight of hand where you imply something and they're like, oh, we get what you're saying, you know, and then that way it's not as bad.
How have you found the market and the audience to be for clean comedy as opposed to something awful, really blue?
Awful. I wish everyone has told me since I started that, oh, you're clean, you're good, right? They're like, you can work the road, you can do this. But the stuff that I talk about, even though it's clean, it doesn't work on the road. It angers people more because they're like, why the hell is this guy talking about breaded chicken? Like, people will get so mad at me for talking about what I talk about sometimes where I'm just confused. Like, I'm like, that's why I wish I had, like, a blue set, you know? Like, at least 15 minutes because it would save me. So But maybe it's age. Maybe it's, you know, just over time. Like, it all will help, hopefully, down the road. But, again, it's – I do think it's just, you know, the cards I was dealt, you know, and I wouldn't try and write something that I didn't feel comfortable doing, so.
Do you think – or how much do you think your material has evolved – since when you started and until now? I mean, it's still clean, but in terms of maybe style or delivery or topics. Yeah,
I honestly think that I realized about 3 years ago, I've been doing stand-up for 10 years, 3 years ago, I realized that I finally learned how to start speaking English on stage. Because when I had these crazy thoughts, there's a filter between my brain and my mouth, and a lot of words were lost. So when I would try and deliver it to the crowd, they would have no clue what I was talking about. You know, and sometimes it would work, sometimes it wouldn't. But within the past 3 years, I've really realized how to get it out better. And like, I'm always trying to figure out what is a joke, right? Like, there's never an actual answer, but I like the idea of searching. And I realized that it's pretty much just giving someone directions, right? Now, people... you have professional and amateur comedians, but I think that we also have to look at that with an audience too. Because if you've never been to a comedy show before, you are an amateur audience member, in my opinion. So you may not understand that you got to take things for face value. You got to understand, don't look into it. It's a joke. It's not real, blah, blah, blah. And it's just like, if you go to Vancouver, and I can tell you, hey man, when you're at the McDonald's, turn right, you're going to see like 4th Street, go left. You know that because you know Vancouver. You're a professional Vancouver person. But if you're telling me, you got to be very detailed about how to get to that destination. So what I've done was, as you can tell, I'm very long-winded. And it's like, so when I have my thing, I will over-explain it so much to the point where I'm like, okay, you know what? This is the directions, but this is too much directions. Then I'll keep whittling down till maybe I have like a 4-step direction. And then that's how... I feel like I can finally start speaking English on stage by adding key words that I think the audience should be aware of, but they're not all the time.
I feel like comedians, they sort of straddle the line between, you know, jokesters, like telling jokes and creating stories. Mm-hmm. How do you go about creating your material in terms of, you know, how long is it till I get to the punchline, or how much background info do I do, but you know, before, you know, how much is banter, how much is actually material?
You know, it's very weird because when I started, like a little just backstory, like I've never in my life watched stand up until I was on stage. So I had no idea. Like, obviously knew street jokes. I remember as a kid thinking, how the hell is a joke created? I never knew stand up was even an option. Like in any sense. So I had no idea on a traditional sense. So everyone used to make fun of me when I started because I would always start with the punchline and explain the joke, right? So my original, when I started, what I would say something so over the top, so weird, then the audience would be like, what? And then I would explain what I meant, and then it would come back around, and they'd be like, oh, you made sense. So... but then over time, a lot of people have considered me a storyteller, which I don't think I am. But I do think I have a story element to my material because I do have some long-winded stuff. I have some one-liners. Like, I really think that I will do anything I can do, right? So I can't really – I'll never stop trying to grow as a comic, you know. And even to this point, it's – you know, every day I learn something new, hopefully. You know, even if I bomb, I've learned something.
Is for you, is there a difference between dumb and stupid? I heard Lewis Black say once that dumb isn't funny.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point, actually. It's like, yeah, dumb is like, you know when something's dumb. You know, but sometimes dumb, if it's done by the right person, is so dumb that it's funny. You know, you're like, this guy is just such an idiot. Like, you know, but yeah, I do think that is true. Like, dumb is just someone going after, in my opinion, in the Lewis Black scenario, going after a response, right? So it's a poorly written dick joke is dumb, in my opinion, just because you're like, oh, these are trigger words. I'm going to create something that's dumb. Like, you're wasting everyone's time. But yeah, stupid for sure could be funny because it's like, I don't know. It's just, I don't know. It's something funny about the word stupid. You know, it's a good word. But yeah, no.
Is a stupid joke different than a bad joke?
Okay, we're getting into some deep stuff here. No, I think, okay, so now here, if we're going to get into this pyramid scheme of words, bad can be broken up into so many things. Bad in itself can be, is it just a bad joke? Is it in bad taste? Is it bad timing? You know, so when you're going to break down into that thing, it's like, yeah, like, a bad joke is for sure different than a stupid joke, because a stupid joke most of the time is when someone just, like a comic especially, would just laugh under their breath. When comics watch comics, they're not really laughing. But when a comic sees a comic and they just kind of laugh and shake their head, that's a stupid joke. They're just like, that is so dumb. But then a bad joke is just like, you know, most of the time you're just like, what are you doing? You know, and everyone, and that's the thing, because to get to a stupid joke, you have to tell bad jokes. You need to experiment. You can't be scared of the audience, because you do need to, you know, plant shit to get flowers. Like, that's the reality of the scenario.
Do you have, what is your, one of your favorite stupid jokes?
Of mine?
Or just, or what?
Just in general?
Yeah.
You know what? I can't even tell you anything stand-up wise that I love. I just heard this story from my friend, and it's just, it's so stupid. It's literally the definition of stupid. It was my friend, and this was like years ago, and he was at a club, and he was like, man, you know, me and my boy were just, you know, we're drinking, we're getting a little drunk, you know, we want to like smoke weed. So then they start smoking weed in the club. And this is like maybe like 6 years ago. You're not allowed to smoke anything in clubs at this time, especially weed. So him and his friend are drunk, and they're smoking weed, and a light shines in their eye. And they both squint their eyes, lean back, and put up two peace signs and, like, pout their lips for, like, 5 seconds. Because they thought someone was taking a picture of them. But it was the security guard shining the flashlight in their eyes. And they were so stupid that they thought that someone was taking a picture. So they both posed for 5 seconds. And the security guard started dying of laughter because he was like, you guys are insane. And he let them stay, but he just obviously told them that he couldn't smoke weed. So like something like that to me, like that's the stuff I find funny. Like even yesterday I was on the subway and I had to like really try and not laugh because it was packed and I was sitting down and there's this guy standing, like his like crotch is right in my face. Like, you know that seat right there? And all of a sudden he pulls out a deck of cards, okay? And, like, he pulls it out, like, literally right in my face. And he starts doing, like, sleight-of-hand magic tricks to the mirror looking at himself. Because he must have been, like, learning magic or something. I don't know what the hell he was doing. But it's, like, one of those things where you look at the scenario and what's happening in it. And that, to me, is the stupidest but funniest thing, right? Where it's so serious, but it's like laughing at a funeral where it's, like, the worst time. But sometimes you just can't help it, you know?
You have one track called Dating. Mm. And, you know, and I think in any art form, dating is one of the oldest, you know, in influences. Dating aside, how much of your personal life goes into your act?
Zero. It's actually like a problem. Like, some people think it's a problem. Like, I'm so disconnected. And it's actually recently, like, even that dating stuff is not even really about me. It's more about just trying to find dating material, you know, like, because for the past 6-7 years I was always trying to write material on relationships because it really does make a difference on the road, and it just never worked. And even with this album, like, it was something that I used to get into another joke, like more as filler. But I will say I'm working now on stuff that is a little bit more personal, and I am trying to get more personal because I don't know why, but like, I know I'm very long-winded, but it's like years ago, I used to, like, I'm Italian Canadian, okay? So I don't have any Italian material. I never really did, but I had this, whenever I do stand-up, people would always tell me that I sometimes remind them at somebody at a party that they were at. Just kind of a guy in the corner talking shit. So then I was like, oh, whatever. Then I started doing one personal story about eating like Italian, like a sandwich. Like the bun is like the size of a football, right? And I would do this whole story about how everyone in my school would make fun of me about this. And it ends up that my friend had like spaghetti in a Ziploc bag. It was like, and it's disgusting. And like, so it was this whole story and it would really work. And then people would come up to me after who experienced the same thing that I did. And this is when I realized how important it is to be personal on stage. Because now I went from a guy at a party to their childhood friend. Do you know what I mean? Like, people were like, man, you remind me of my friend from when I was a kid. And that is, like, everything in this world is nostalgia now, right? And that, I'm like, when you can have a personal, and that's why, you know, the quote-unquote hack material always does the best, because you're bringing people to a deeper mindset than just a stupid joke, right? A stupid joke is funny, you'll remember it, but you are not going to be as deep as someone who is getting personal, and then especially if you've experienced that also as an audience member.
You mentioned you're Italian. You have, I think, two tracks on the album about food.
Yeah, that's where my Italian blood comes out. I will always be writing food jokes. It's but yeah, what were you going to say?
Hey, well, you got peanuts and salad empires. Do you have any crazy Italian family food stories?
Well, like we make like tomato sauce every year, you know, and it's always a disaster. Like it's always like everyone's arguing, yelling at each other, you know, and like we are a big food family. Like my family still gets together on Sundays and has Sunday lunch, you know, and so it's like, I don't know if I have any, you know, if there's anything crazy, I would for sure have figured out how to do it as a joke by now. But like, it's just, it is such a big thing, you know, and I actually, at this point, I'm actually a vegetarian and I stopped eating meat and for the most part, and everyone in my family, like, first of all, thought I was crazy. My grandmother thought that because she was watching Italian news, there was someone who killed somebody in Italy and they were a vegetarian. She thought I was going to kill somebody. She thought it was like this first sign of a killer. And I'm like, so it's just like explaining, I guess, new age things. Vegetarian is not even obviously new age, but it's like a huge craze now with the gluten-free stuff to very traditional people is very hard.
What do you think food, like, you know, when people think of Italy or Italian culture, it's food right away.
It is, yeah.
Why do you think that is?
It's pizza for sure, right off the top. Like, it's pizza is obviously, and then it's just, there's something, I don't know, like, Italian food is one of those things where it's like, you can't really get it easy other than pizza. You can't, there's no fast food Italian restaurants, right? So it is one of those things, but it's in so many, like you got to look at the Italian culture is also connected with a lot of like 90s mob movies, 80s mob movies. And it's always like these guys who look cool in a dark restaurant, you know, sipping, eating spaghetti, meatballs. And there's been so many like jokes about spaghetti and meatballs and, you know, like, it's just, there's so many food references. And on the other hand, it's just good food. Like, really, it caters all people. Like, yeah. You know, in the purest form, it is just really good food.
I mean, I agree. I work at a pizza place, so.
Yeah, so you know.
Yeah, it's, but like traditional, like Neapolitan, like yeah. Pizza alla Bretto, like
yeah, really good stuff. It's done, especially if you know how to do it right. Like, it's, you know, they really know what they're doing and they're very passionate people in general. So, and that's the good thing about being, you know, coming from like a passionate bloodline is like once you do find passion in something, like you will lose your life for it if you have to.
And then you've got, you know, a lot of other random topics. You talk about math. You talk about the letter Z.
Yes.
How would you describe your relationship with those two particular subjects?
In life, not good. Like I failed English probably every year after high school. And I'm not, like, I'm good at, like, I wish, like, I pretend to be better at math than I actually am. But I do like finding, like, little loopholes, right? Like, I like tricking people into jokes, you know? And that was the one thing where I've realized when I told you I learned how to speak English, like, what I'm trying to do in comedy, in stand-up, is trying to master the art of confusion. So when you all of a sudden start talking about the alphabet, the audience is like, where the hell is this guy going? And then you have that letter Z joke. That's a stupid joke. I don't know if you can hear the whole thing there, but it's like, it literally, I don't know, whatever. But it's literally just talking about how the alphabet ends with the letter Z because it doesn't want to end in a question anymore. That's the joke. And that's what I'm saying. That's a stupid joke. That is literally, you know, you're doing exactly what I told you people do when they see a stupid joke. They shake their head and they're like, what a dumb joke. But it's like, I'm also aware that my demeanor with that joke also adds a little bit. Because people, when they first meet me in life or in stand-up, they, especially before, like before I lost weight, like I was like this, I was bigger, I was like 250, you know, and they were like, oh, this guy's gonna be some douchebag jock talking about girls or whatever. And then I'm talking about the alphabet, and they're like, what the hell's going on here, you know?
Is it, you know, you mentioned you failed English, and is there a certain amount of irony now that you're, in effect, a writer of English?
It is actually, like, one of the funniest things, because I hated it. But then I think about being a kid, and, like, I used to love writing stories, right? But it's like, you know, it's just like, once you start getting told that you suck at something from school, you do lose interest in it. And I honestly believe that if I paid attention more in school, I wouldn't be sitting here with you right now. I just, for some reason, was like, no, I don't, I never even knew what the hell I was going to do with my life. But I always did what I wanted to do. And that was, I got lucky because I could have definitely fallen down the wrong path. And I still could. I'm not living comfortably right now, you know, like things are going well, but who knows what's going to happen in 5 years, you know, like, but I do think that there is an ironic thing because, you know, I just was not good at it. Like, and here's the thing that sucks, to get a writing job, my opinion, it doesn't even matter if you're funny. They just want people who are good at basic writing. Like, can you write a paragraph properly? Can you use grammar correctly? Like, can you spell? And I feel like that's the first thing they look at when they don't know you, because they're like, we don't want to deal with you having to spell check you, you know, like we're funny. We need someone who can just write, you know? So it is something that I wish I was actually joking around with my friend. We were going to take ESL classes because it's the cheapest form to learn basic English. And we haven't gotten around to it yet, but it was something that we have been talking about.
you alluded to there earlier. You obviously said you jokingly learned how to speak English, but I think the other aspect of comedy is image and sort of, you know, how one, not necessarily what they wear, but just how they present themselves on the stage. How much of a journey was that for you in terms of finding that aspect of your act?
You know what? It was actually like, I don't know. Okay. So I don't know how much of, I don't even really care to talk about it anymore, but since we have to, I will. I had a pretty fast start in stand-up. Within 3 years, I won $25,000, like best comic in Canada, more Canada, but it's billed as North America, and it was a contest. Doesn't mean that I'm the best, I just happened to win. I went to Just for Laughs, and I won a Canadian Comedy Award for Best Newcomer. I think that all of that was based off of my persona. My demeanor on stage, whatever the hell it was making people laugh, okay? And I could not stand people laughing at me and not what I'm saying. It bothered me so much. And there was, I can tell you, and I won't tell you because I don't want to waste more time, but there was 3 separate occasions, okay? One of them was at a very popular club that's been around for 30 years in downtown Toronto, where I walked on stage and I'm just like, hey, I'm like, what's going on? And the audience starts laughing. And I'm like, okay, guys, like, seriously. And then they keep laughing. I had to do 7 minutes. I could not, they literally would not stop laughing for 7 minutes straight. And I'm like, I have to go. And they were dying. Like, people, like, were applauding. And I got off. And the manager was like, honestly, man, I've been here for 20 years. I've never seen that happen before. And I'm like, well, what the hell, man? Like, I came here to work on my material. I'm not a clown. So that was something where my persona, because the thing that I always looked at it was, the audience judges you before you even hit the mic, right? So there was a period for like maybe 4 months where I even worked on how I walked to the microphone, because I'm like, I wouldn't like do different walks, but I would be more conscious of how I was walking, because, you know, am I running to the mic? Am I slowly walking? Am I pointing? You know, what the hell's going on? Because all that stuff really does make a difference before they know who you are, right? And then within the first couple minutes, they, you know, it's very hard to win them over if they don't like you.
You end the album with a bit about kung fu movies. Mm-hmm. Are you a fan of that style of entertainment?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I love kung fu. That was the whole idea, right? Like all these EPs, I was trying to have like some kind of theme in it. And then this year, like going back and forth between LA and, you know, going and just having a lot of downtime, you know, thanks to the good people at Netflix, I got to really reopen up a huge thing that I, because I grew up in Scarborough, you know, I had a very multicultural upbringing. Me and my friends used to love watching kung fu movies. You get out of it, but then, you know, the amount of stuff I watched in the past 2 years on Netflix, I was just like, you know, really brought me back to it. And I really do love the culture of it, you know, like I think it's such a strong culture, and it's, you know, even in that joke, I talk about just like there's so much less complaining in kung fu movies than in North American movies. And, you know, you look at any movie that's made in North America, it's always like a hot guy lives in New York, a hot girl is in New York, they're both broke, but they live in New York and they're looking for love, but they're both hot. You watch a kung fu movie, it most of the time starts off with like a guy and a girl who've been married, and one of them gets kidnapped or something happens, and instead of complaining, they're just like, we're going to kill everybody until we're back together. Like, they just do things. And I really do like that vacation of the complaining.
Do you know what your favorite all-time kung fu movie is?
You know, this is the problem. I don't remember any of the names. But I do like the Five Deadly Venoms. Five Deadly Venoms. That one was really good. I honestly like the last thing that I watched a lot of was the, I don't know if you've seen it, it's on Netflix. It's not even really like kung fu based. It is, but it's not kung fu. But it's like the Bruce Lee story. It's 50 minutes, and there's like maybe like 40 episodes, and it's just the first season, and it's just like, I don't know. I just find it like crazy. But no, I do like I just can't. The names are the ones that I can't even remember. It's like if you ask me what song I like, I'm like, I don't know what the song's called. I can tell you what track it is, but are you big into kung fu?
I haven't seen a lot of kung fu movies. Like, you know, like I know Bruce Lee, I know Brandon Lee, David Carradine.
Yeah.
You know, that's about the extent of mine. I mean, I grew up watching Jim Carrey and Robin Williams. I mean, that's that, you know, Ace Ventura, Mrs. Doubtfire, that's my generation. Oh, right?
Well, yeah. Like that's, yeah, for me too, right? Like it's, but actually like the cover of my album here is actually based off of Drunken Master with Jackie Chan. So that's literally the exact same cover, right. Just instead of a bottle of booze on my head, it's a microphone. So it's so Drunken Master was amazing. Like, it's obviously, you've seen that, that's the cover. I just, yeah.
Did you ever see that kung fu movie? It's written and directed and stars Steve Odekirk, who co-wrote Ace Ventura 2, and it's called like The Chosen One. And what it is is he took an old, I think it was kung fu movie, that was in Chinese or Japanese, and basically kept the original plot and then just
redubbed it
with himself.
I thought that was
maybe it's not The Chosen One.
No,
but
I know what you're talking about. I did see that. I didn't like it though. But I know exactly, it's like right on the tip of my tongue.
Kung Pao, Enter the Fist, yeah.
Kung Pao, I did see that. It was like, to me, it was like just kind of like, that was dumb. Like,
Yeah.
But I did, I can see like that being short and funny, but to watch it for like a whole movie was too much, yeah.
You stated earlier that you know, even though you're moving to LA, you don't necessarily, you know, you're not thinking about television or films, but I know you did do a film called Picture Day with Tatiana Maslany before she, you know, just right when she was exploding.
Yeah.
What was that experience like?
That was actually insane. Like, I've never done anything to that level before. And like, Tatiana was obviously amazing to work with. And she was like, really made the whole thing like awesome. And Kate was the director, and she, like, they knew that I had a comedy background. So, like, Kate just kind of came up to me and she's like, look, you can improvise everything. Just make sure you stick to the main points because you got to move the story. Like, because I was, like, one of those story plot guys in the movie. And, like, it was unbelievable, like, the whole thing. And then, like, for her to, like, blow up, like, literally the next 6 months after that. Because that movie actually, like, went all over TIFF. So, like, at that point, I was doing stand-up for, like, around that time, I won all that stuff. I had to fly back from a tour out east, okay, like Halifax, all that, to do 3 days of TIFF. And I walked, like, the red carpet, and, like, I was sitting in the front of the theater, and there's, like, 500 people. And, like, Tatiana actually, like, she did it. She actually, like, shouted me out, like, and I was just like, this is insane, where she told everybody that she was just like, yeah, like, this was Mark's first movie. And, you know, it was just, like, she, like, was super nice. Like, unbelievable. So, and she's amazing, obviously.
What was the TIFF experience like? I mean, I've been to some festivals here and there, and it just seems a little bit, it seems like it can be a bit overwhelming.
You know what? It definitely, like, there was a lot. Like, for me, I'm obviously, like, thinking that it's hilarious. I'm, like, walking around laughing the whole time. But it's like, yeah, I can see, like, so for someone like Tatiana, who was the main character, like, I could for sure see it being stressful because she would, like, be, like, there, you know, talking to this person, doing this interview, doing that. Like, and I think it's one of those things where it's good to have more problems than no problems. But, like, it was honestly, like, I'm very happy that I got to experience it when I did. And, you know, I met some cool people from it, got a little bit of, you know, momentum. And then, you know, you just from there, you just move on, you know, and flew back to Halifax.
You know, a lot of comedians end up writing for television, you know, people mm-hmm. like Dion Cole, who was on Conan and then in Black-ish and, you know, all those guys. Is do you think that is going to be something that you'll push for in the future, or do you just want to do the stand-up?
No, so I'll reframe or phrase what I said. So I don't care to be on camera, but I do like production. So I do want to get into writing for television. I do want to produce a show. I do want to write short films. Like, I want to 100% get into that, and that's kind of the juices that I'm hoping are in the air in Los Angeles, because it's like, I'm going to have a lot of downtime. And I'm like, why can't I write a short film? You know, why can't I do this? To actually do it is a whole other story. But you have enough people out there where everyone's just in the same position as me, but they want someone who has something for them to do, right? So I do want to, I was honest to God, the whole reason why I'm probably sitting with you right now, part of other reasons, but was because the idea of a writer's room. Because when I got out of high school, I went to Seneca orientation, and I applied for creative advertising, digital media arts, and police foundations, because I had to just throw something else in there. And I remember the creative advertising one was advertising, and the guy was like, you know what? If you think the idea of sitting in a writer's room till 5 in the morning, eating Chinese food, drinking coffee, yelling at each other, figuring out stuff is too overwhelming for you, you got to leave, because that's what this business is. And to me, I'm like, that's amazing. Like, I love the idea of, like, a think tank, like, just, you know, like, you have a bunch of people throwing ideas off each other and just creating. Like, I think that's unbelievable.
Would you say you have a favorite late night comedian host right now?
You know, I actually don't watch late night TV things, but I do like, I don't know, like, I've always liked Jimmy Kimmel, you know? Conan is obviously, like, you know, he's doing, like, the whole, I think Conan is more of, like, now the underground, even though he's still big, but he's more of an alternative where, obviously, everything that happened with him. But, and I will say, with Jimmy Fallon, I did not really care for him. Like, I don't want to be like, oh, I hated him before, but really, it was annoying. He used to laugh on Saturday Night Live, and it was just like, look, Horatio Sands can laugh. You can't, okay? Like, stop it. But I, like, have over-the-top respect for him after he's on The Tonight Show or The Late, whatever he does, because it's a perfect job for him. Like, he can sing, he can do all this stuff, he can break character all he wants, and he is a perfect host for that show. Like, I think he's gonna, you know, like, it's perfect for him. Like, it really does work amazingly.
Like so many comedians, you've got into the podcasting game yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
That medium in particular seems to be a new haven for comedians, a safe space almost, if you will. What was your impetus for getting into that?
Well, like most things I do in my life, I don't really care for them before I do them. I obviously like doing podcasts, never wanted to do my own. I don't really listen to podcasts, right? And it's no disrespect, but I just never, like, I don't even really listen. Like, I listen to music and that's it. I don't listen to radio, nothing. But I had all this equipment and a keyboard in my basement, like a music keyboard. And I'm like, I'm such a loser. You know, I buy all this stuff, it's sitting in my basement, I'm not doing anything. So I call my friend and I'm like, look, man, my friend Garrett, I'm like, you got to come over. We got to record something. I got to get something going. I just want to record something quick. Maybe we'll do a couple 10-minute episodes. So we end up coming up with this thing where it's called GJ Reviews, and it's on the whole thing where he reads Yelp reviews from No Frills, which is a grocery store in Ontario. And it ends up being like hilarious. And then so we record 6 episodes in an hour, and he's playing keyboard on it, literally just reading the reviews. Every episode was a different No Frills. And then I'm like, you know what? There might be something with the idea of 10 minutes, because when are people really listening to podcasts if they don't drive? You know, on the bus maybe, walking to work, going to the thing. And it's like, I think the idea of 10 minutes with niche subjects can be kind of cool, right? Where you can say, hey, you know what? This guy's into beard oils. We have a beard podcast. We have a coffee podcast, a skateboarding podcast, you know? And that's kind of where it started growing. And, you know, as of now, there's probably like over 30 podcasts with 6 to 12 episodes, you know, which is really like an hour per podcast, 2 hours, but it's different enough to keep jumping. And that's kind of where that all happened.
Kind of circling back to what we were talking about earlier, is there a certain amount of freedom in podcasting that can afford a comedian that maybe, you know, live or on television can't, because you can literally say whatever you want?
Yeah, and that was the thing that I didn't want to have any input on. I didn't want to have any creative input. Like, obviously, if you want to bounce ideas off me, I'm going to help you, like, because I love doing it. But if you came to me or I came to you, I'm like, you do whatever you want. As long as there's nothing like it that I'm doing already with someone else, that's it. I'm like, you want to talk about tablecloths? Do it, you know? Like, if it's going to be something that could cause a problem, I'd be like, okay, you got to make sure it's good, you know? Like, if you're going to do something more for effect. But, yeah, you really are, you can record a podcast in the bathroom if you want. No one can stop you. Like, you're allowed to upload it, you know, like, it's really no different than a YouTube video, but podcasts are way more accessible. The difference is less people know how to upload podcasts to like an actual iTunes and all that stuff, right? Because it is a little bit of work, but once you get it going, it's obviously easy, right? So,
yeah.
But yeah, I do think it's like unlimited. There's the sky's the limit, really.
Where do you see that medium going? You know, iTunes has been criticized for basically giving podcasts away for free, mm-hmm. you know, as opposed to like, I think it was Kevin Pollak that said he tried to go to iTunes and sell, you know, like something like 10 podcasts for a dollar. Like, well, we don't have the algorithm for that. Do you think more people will be able to make money or something like that in the future? Or is that maybe besides the point for something like this?
Well, I think in the end, no, like we'll never live in a world where everyone's going to be an entrepreneur. Right. So if you work for a network that creates podcasts, which there's a bunch of them out there, yeah, you could probably make some money because they've built a following. They have advertisers. In the end, anyone can make money if they want to just wake up an hour early and try and get a sponsor, try and get an advertiser. The idea of podcasting, though, is like, and it's like stand up and it's like music. It's like, it's just so accessible. It's hard to monetize it. And there's obviously things like Patreon and all that, which are helping. But on the other hand, it's like, unless you're a celebrity, I don't even think people would pay unless you're doing like research on something, you know? Like, cause they're like, what am I, like even stand up, people don't understand how much work goes into that 5 minutes that they've seen, right? Because you're literally up there with a microphone and nothing else, where a guitarist can go on stage and sing you Green Day with two strings, and the audience is like, oh my God, like I could never do the confidence of that, right? But it's the same thing with podcasting, and there are people. I actually was talking with one guy from Death Squad last 2 years ago, and he was telling me that one of their biggest listening, this is good knowledge, one of their biggest listening areas is actually Alberta. It's the second largest for Death Squad. Like for this guy, it was Alberta. So they go out to Alberta, and that's where it can help comics, because you can obviously see where the listeners are coming from, right? So if you blow up in Australia for the podcast, you're like, oh man, I gotta go to Australia and capitalize on this, right? But I think it would be just a pay what you can scenario. Like that would be the only way, unless you're working with a company that will pay you.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Speaking of Alberta, you know, as someone who's toured, do you find a Toronto audience different than a Halifax audience, different than a Calgary audience, for example?
For sure. Yeah. No, 100%. Like I think. Okay, get ready. This is going to be a little long-winded. When you ask me certain questions, it's going to get deep. So here's the thing. I think a comic will always come to a point where they hit a fork in the road. Because I myself, and everything I've said so far is my own opinions. I'm not speaking on behalf of anybody else. I think that audiences are the same all around the world. But people are different. That's obviously stupid to say. But an audience is different than a group of people. Because when you have a group of strangers, anywhere in the world, and they're brought together and they're on the same wavelength, yeah, they're going to be amazing all around the world. But if they're, this guy over here is drunk, this girl's partying with her friends, the guy in the back doesn't care, he's just trying to hit on this girl, right? Like, when you have all this happening and everyone has different mindsets, you're now dealing with the mentality of that town. So Edmonton, the average Joe in Edmonton is going to be different than the average Joe in Toronto, different than the average Joe in Montreal, different than the average Joe in Vancouver, LA, wherever. So it becomes harder if you are not liked by that average Joe to connect. But like I said, this is how people don't realize how important an MC is, because an MC is the person, or the host is who goes on first. And it is their job to bring the whole show on that wavelength. It's like a mob mentality, really. Like when you have that hive brain, that one brain, it's unbelievable all around the world. But it's the hard part is getting them all on the same wavelength.
So you've got two farewell shows coming up here in Toronto. How are you going to approach these shows, knowing that this is going to be your last before you make the move? Are you going to play off nostalgia at all, or are you just going to think you'll just do what you always do?
No, so the Saturday show, which is, I guess, February 3rd, it is actually a variety show. And this is what I was trying to figure out, because I'm like, even though I love doing stand-up, I've filmed stupid sketches before. I've filmed stupid short films. Like, I've done this stuff, and I want to have a hint of it in the show. So the Saturday show is actually going to be more of less comedy, stand-up actually. It'll be like two or three stand-up acts, but I have like two bands, I have videos, I'm going to have like, there's one band, it's Garrett Jameson and Sporadicus, and Sporadicus is an amazing band, and then Garrett is my friend I do a lot of stuff with, and they collaborated with this thing where he essentially created music for all his jokes. There's another guy, DJ Moves, and he is he does like loops, like he'll do like beatboxing stuff, so he'll open the show. And so that's how I'm doing it. But then the show Monday at the Rivoli will be just pure stand-up. That will be just like a straight-up classic stand-up show. So I do want to give everybody a little bit, because it's like I love the idea of the variety show. It's just hard to do it, right?
What do you think you'll miss most about Toronto?
The shows, the people, the city. Like, grew up in Scarborough. Like, I've been in downtown Toronto, like, since I was probably, like, 16. You know, like, I love this city. I think it's, honest to God, and I will argue anybody that wants to fight this, the best headquarters for comedy. Because the amount of shows you have, the amount of, Like, you gotta understand, like, Toronto is a very diverse place, right? Like, it is, if not the most diverse place. I think someone just told me that Dubai was more multicultural than Toronto, which is still arguable. But it's like, Toronto's a super multicultural place, so you're dealing with a lot of stuff all the time here, right? And you really just grow past so many things, and there's so many different networks of comedians here, and, you know, there's so many different people who, to me, it really feels like it's a new thing in Toronto, like stand-up. Like, it really does. It's been around forever, but there's been a huge boom in the past 5 years, and I'm just going to miss, essentially, you know, talking shit, because I love doing it in Toronto. Like, it's just such a laid-back place, you know?
Do you think, you know, you'll be able to... How do you think living in LA will affect your act at all in terms of, like, oh, now I can make, you know, more fun of Canadians because I'm now, you know, one living abroad or whatever?
Yeah, I think it's just going to be more, like, I have to be a little bit more professional about it. Like, I have a whole act that I will never do in Toronto. Like, you'll never see it unless I'm showcasing or on the road. But down there, I have to be more professional. I have to do my quote-unquote A material, which I don't even have, because nothing's guaranteed. I have to do my best material at the worst show, because now I need these comics to understand that I am actually a working comic moving to a new place, not this is my second time on stage, right? So, and that was what I've already adjusted to before, whereas, you know, I had to go into a show and really try and do well, where for me, the enjoyment comes from talking about peanuts, not them doing well. Like, I love the idea of an audience responding to it, but that's going to be the hardest part.
Well, you have two farewell shows coming up. You got Saturday, February 3rd.
Yes, at Comedy Bar.
At the Comedy Bar, and you've got Monday, February 5th at the Rivoli.
Yes.
Mark DeMont, bonus, thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you for having me, man. Thank you.
And best of luck. And then move out west.
Yes, thank you.
Hopefully you won't get any super cold weather.
Yeah, that would suck, actually.
Cheers, man.